Ask you with me here at the start to look at this episode from the life of Jesus that surely has to be the record of one of the most awkward moments in the life of Jesus. In Matthew 16, in verse 21, the text says, "From that time Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the hands of the elders and the chief priests and scribes, and be killed and be raised up on the third day." So he is forecasting the crucifixion, right? This key moment in the whole gospel story. Verse 22, Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, "God forbid it, Lord, this shall never happen to you." We appreciate with me that we are looking at this with hindsight, that in the moment, what the Lord had said was preposterous to Peter, and what he was saying was absolutely the right thing at this critical moment. And he's taken this noble stand about what Jesus has suggested and saying, "No, no, that can't be the way that it is." To which Jesus replies, "Get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me, for you are not setting your mind on God's interest, but on man's." I don't know that I've appreciated, though that I've known that story for a long, long time, how really hard it would have been for Peter to hear those words from Jesus. I mean, we understand now how foolhardy this thing was that he was saying, but he didn't. And to have said what I think he imagined was noble, and to receive this kind of response from Jesus, it's kind of hard and direct? I suspect those were very difficult words for Peter to hear and process, you think? And yet, he does. He receives these very hard words from Jesus. There is no evidence that he reacted badly to this, that he was stubborn and rebellious and refused to hear what the Lord said. Certainly, he didn't get angry and walk away. And you're saying, well, who would do that? Well, read John 6. A whole lot of people that were following Jesus would hear things they didn't want to hear and just stop walking with him when they heard hard sayings. Peter heard something pretty hard. And he's sticking with Jesus. So I wanted you to think about that, because one of the points we've made now in every single session is that what we've been talking about, this ability to take a conversation that is high stakes and emotional and controversial and to be able to handle it in a reasonable way and have good outcomes, that to a lot of people, they just don't see that happening. They've had too many failed conversations to believe that crucial conversations can work out well. And yet I think we all know that that isn't absolutely true in every case, because all of us have had crucial conversations where someone had to share information with us, like Jesus shares with Peter here. That's very hard for us to hear, and yet we were willing to hear it. Will you think about moments in your life when that's happened to you? If I could kind of stir your thinking, maybe it was something that happened with your mother. Maybe your mom came to you and she said, "You know, honey, I love you, and I know you're trying to be a good mom to my grandkids, but I've been seeing something going on with you and your kids, and I think you're making a mistake, and I want to talk to you about that." Ooh, talk about a crucial conversation. Someone starts talking about your parenting, and that conversation gets hit real hot real quick, right? Unless mama's talking to you, because you know she loves you and cares about you, and y'all both want the kids to turn out great, right? And so when she started talking, even though they were hard words, we were willing to hear, right? Or maybe it was something different. Maybe you've been through a bad spot in your marriage and you couldn't seem to fix the problem, and so you found some older couple, maybe an elder and his wife, and you came over to their house and said, "Hey, we need your help. Would you work with us?" And so maybe even for a few weeks, they met with you regularly, and over the course of those conversations, at some point, guys, that elder had to look at you and say, "You know, I love you, But this thing you've just said that you're doing in your marriage, that is against God's will. That's sinful. You can't treat your wife that way. And that's one of the reasons you're having trouble in your marriage. Those are hard words to hear, right? We guys don't like being told we're wrong. And yet you knew this guy loved you. And like you, he wanted your marriage to succeed. You knew that about him. And so when he spoke those hard words, you were willing to hear. Do you see what I'm saying? And if we will start looking back, all of us can find moments in our life where we were willing to hear and receive hard information, to wade into a crucial conversation like that. And even though it was directed at us and a mistake on our part, we were willing to respond well, like Peter did here. So the question is, why did that happen? Why were we willing to do that? And you say, well, because it was my mom. Actually, I would agree with you. I can tell you, folks, anytime my dad comes to me with anything, even if he's got to call me out where he feels like my behavior has been out of line, and he's done that, when my dad talks to me, I listen. Even when I don't want to hear what he has to say, I still listen. Because I know he loves me. And I know my dad is always acting in my best interest. And so when my dad starts talking to me about something, I feel safe. Even listening to information that's really hard to hear. So if you would process all that with me, I think there are some lessons that we need to learn here. First lesson is that crucial conversations do not fail because of the information. It is not true that you just can't talk about religion and politics. You just can't talk to everybody about religion and politics because you don't always feel safe having those conversations. The information is not the problem. Sometimes we hear very hard information and take it well and have a good conversation. Secondly, it's not even about the personalities involved. Those of us who can be a little more temperamental and volatile still have moments where, in spite of those propensities, we're willing to hear. It's not about information. It's not about personalities. What it is about is safety. I feel safe when this person is talking to me about this difficult information. And so I think we're learning then another key piece of managing crucial conversations well. Last night we talked about dialogue and how what we need is when we go into these crucial conversations, we need everybody dumping in their bucket, right? Everyone who has a stake in this, we need Acts 15, where everyone speaks up and freely shares their thoughts and opinions and ideas and feelings of all that they have to share about whatever the issue is at stake. But here's the deal. They're only going to do that if they feel safe. And so tonight, the lesson is going to be make it safe. If you want people to participate in a meaningful way in a crucial conversation, you got to learn to make it safe. In this session, I want to identify two fundamental safety issues or two kinds of safety that we need to address, or two things, maybe it would be better to say it this way, two things that we need to address in order to make people feel safe. So if you got your handout, I'm going to give you the first one I'd like you to write down with me. To make people feel safe entering into a crucial conversation with us, then one of the first things we must do is establish mutual purpose. Would you write that down, please? We need to establish mutual purpose. Someone says that sounds like a bunch of jargon. What does it really mean? I'm glad you asked because I want to talk about that. Let's break it down. When we talk about purpose, what we're really talking about is what we want from this conversation. It goes to things like motive. Why are we talking about this? When there's been a problem in Bible class and an elder is meeting with a parent and a teacher, what do we want to come out of this? What do we want to accomplish with this conversation? What is our purpose? But the thing we have to remember is that when we're having crucial conversations, the other participants, they want something too. They have an objective or an agenda. They want some things to be accomplished. They have motives here. So everybody comes to the conversation wanting something. Mutual purpose are the purposes we both share as we wade into this conversation. So, you know, when you're talking to your mom about bringing up your kids or her grandkids, one of the things you know is you both want the right thing done for these children, right? You're having the conversation because you both want that. That would be your mutual purpose. You listen to that older elder when, guys, he calls you out about something you're doing in your marriage because you know that he wants the same thing you want for your marriage to be great. He wants your marriage to be one that honors God. You share that mutual purpose. You see that? It is so important when you're having a crucial conversation to identify those common purposes that we share. Oftentimes, what gets us into trouble is when we become suspicious about what the other guy is really after. Can I give you a hypothetical? I want to imagine you all own your own business. Can y'all do that with me tonight? I want you to imagine that you are a business owner, and Mark, hypothetical Mark, is one of your employees. And Mark comes into your office one day, and he's got a list of 12 budget cuts that he says to you, this will help save our company money. And so what I wanted to do is talk to you about 12 proposed budget cuts. Here's the problem. Mark was in your office last week, and Mark was asking for a raise, and you told him, listen, this is not good economic times for the company. There's no money in the budget for you to have a raise. Now he shows up a week later saying, hey, I've got some ideas for cutting the budget to help the company. What are you thinking? He's not helping the company, right? His real motive is that he's in this to help himself. I'm going to tell you something. How's that conversation about budget cuts going to go when you don't believe he's really after the same thing you are? You see the problem there? When you don't share common purpose, it derails the entire conversation. You don't feel safe opening up and talking to him about this stuff because you don't think he's after the same thing that you are. So purpose, the belief in a crucial conversation that we're after the same thing, this is really important in making this thing work. Now, I think that as disciples, when it comes to mutual purpose, we have a huge advantage. Because when it comes to bedrock things that drive us and move us to do what we do in life, you and I already share the same purposes. Have you thought about that? I mean, at a fundamental level, we're all trying to do the right thing. 1 Corinthians 6, verse 20. We are determined to live our lives to the glory of God. Isn't that what you're trying to do? Y'all can kind of react to that, like nod your head up, down, and say you're with me on that. We're trying to live our lives to God's glory. Colossians 1 in verse 10. Our desire is to please God in everything we do, in every respect. Isn't that what your life is about? I want to bring him glory. I want to do what he said and please him. My objective, Philippians 3 and verse 12, is to gain the prize. I'm on this road leading to heaven. That's the one thing that I do. Isn't that what your life is about too? Don't you want to go to heaven more than anything else? That's one of the purposes that drives your behavior. And I would throw some other ones in there. Matthew 28, verse 19. We're out trying to help other people go to heaven too. One of my purposes is to reach out to people and help them know Jesus. In Ephesians chapter 4, more specific to us, the first three verses there, we are diligently trying to preserve the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. What I think we fail to realize sometimes is that fundamentally, all of us who follow Jesus are trying to do the same thing, right? So when we wade into a crucial conversation with one another, we already share mutual purpose. In fact, folks, for me, in crucial conversations, these become my defaults. I go back to them again and again and again. To illustrate, I'm talking to a married couple here who's struggling, having big issues in their marriage. And if you ever had a conversation like that, that they start getting mad at each other right there in front of you, and that thing starts to heat up, and you think it's about to go off the rails. You know when that happens, you know what I say to people? I say, hey, guys, hang on a minute. Will you remember that all of us want the same thing? What we're trying to do here is get this marriage to a place where it pleases God and gives you the blessing God intended. Isn't that what y'all want too? What we're trying to figure out here is God's will for your marriage, because I know that all of us believe it, doing His will is the most important thing. You see how that works? We all really want the same thing. That's the common purpose that we share. If you've got to have a meeting with the elders because something happened in Bible class with your kid and you're upset with the teacher, so here you are, elder, parent, teacher. What common purposes do you share? You know, if I was going to have a conversation like that, I think I'd want to start off by saying, you know, I know we all want the same thing here. We all just care about going to heaven, right? And we want to please God in everything we do. And when it comes to these Bible classes, what do we want? Bible classes that are great for our kids, where they learn about the will of God so that they can grow up to serve Him, right? We all share the same purpose. We're all after the same thing. Even in our personal conflicts, isn't that what we're about? Hey, I just want to live life that glorifies God. If I've got a fuss with a brother, God wants us to be at peace with each other. All I want here is to find a path for us to work this out in a way that brings Him honor and glory. Listen, folks, that's not a gimmick. That's who we are. And so what we need to do when we wade into these crucial conversations is remind ourselves we're all trying to do the same thing. So I got to tell you, of all the things that I have learned from this book, I probably use this principle more than any other. When conversations start to heat up, I'll just pause and say, hey, can I just remind us that we all want the same thing here? We're all pulling in the same direction. We're trying to achieve the same direction, or the same thing. Let's not forget that. Establishing mutual purpose helps make people feel safe participating in the conversation. Now, I'm going to plug something in here that I usually spend a lot more time on. So, Tim, I'm hoping I'm not opening a can of worms, because I usually spend a whole lesson talking about this, but I think it's really important. So you notice my last little question down there on the handout you got is, what is the difference between strategy and purposes? I want to talk to you about that. Because in managing these conversations, I think it is vital that we know the difference between a purpose and a strategy. So can I comment about that quickly? First of all, our purpose is the objective. Our purpose is what we want to accomplish. We want to iron out this Bible class problem so we can have great classes for our kids so they learn to serve God and we can all go to heaven. Okay? That's our purpose. Our strategies are the methods and tools that we might use to accomplish our purpose. Here's why it's important to know the difference. If our purpose is a good purpose, more importantly, if it's a God-given purpose, like doing His will and bringing Him glory, that's non-negotiable, folks. We're not ever going to have a meeting with another disciple where we say, okay, let's give up on trying to serve God, or let's forget heaven as an objective. That's never going to happen, right? So most of the time, purposes aren't really negotiable. But strategies are. What do I mean by that? Sometimes there's more than one right way to do something. And so I need to be a little bit flexible sometimes about the strategies and hang on tight to the purposes. And it's vital that I know the difference. So let me illustrate that biblically. Acts 15. And I'm not going to the circumcision controversy in Acts 15. Will you go to the end of Acts 15? Did y'all know that there is another crucial conversation in Acts chapter 15? This one is at the very end of the chapter, beginning in verse 36. I mean, it's like Acts 15 is the Bible chapter on crucial conversations. In this case, the conversation is between two disciples. It's between Paul and Barnabas. And it's Saturday evening, and you guys are sitting in a church building. I know you're good Bible students, and I suspect you know the background of this story, right? They're getting ready to head out on another journey, and they're wrestling with a decision. Do you remember this? Do we take John Mark? Question, is taking John Mark a purpose or a strategy? It's a strategy. The purpose is to go spread the gospel. That's non-negotiable. We must go spread the gospel. But taking John Mark along, that's negotiable. You can still do the work without taking John Mark, and you can do the work and take John Mark. Whether he goes or not, well, that's one way to do it and not the only way to do it. You see what I'm saying? Paul and Barnabas don't agree about it. It would be interesting to take a vote and see who's with who. Was Paul right or Barnabas was right? I won't go down that path tonight. Are they at a hopeless impasse? Paul says, he abandoned us last time. I don't want him to go. Barnabas says, he deserves a second chance. We should take him. Is that a hopeless impasse? They're never going to fix this problem, right? Wrong. Because they recognize that it's just a strategy and there are other options. What impresses me about this story is ultimately they were able to find another strategy that in my judgment wound up being an even better one. They say, well, wait a minute. You don't want to take John Mark? Fine. Paul, you take somebody else. Barnabas says, I'll take John Mark. Now instead of having two workers, we have four workers going out and doing this thing. You see, they were willing to work the strategy to make it, to accommodate both of them, right? The mission was non-negotiable. They had to go preach the gospel. How they were going to go about doing that, well, there was some room for negotiation there. What they found when they sat down and talked about it is there were actually other options, other possibilities. So we need to appreciate how important it is to make that distinction. I think it has led to needless conflict among brethren when we fail to identify what is a purpose and what is a strategy. I've been preaching for a little over 3 decades, and I got to tell you, folks, I have not seen any church conflicts over big stuff, over fundamental purposes. I've not had a problem in the church where someone was saying, hey, we need to depart from the teaching of Scripture. We don't have controversies about things like that. We've got controversies over little stuff. Most of the time over stuff that's strategy. We could do it this way or we could do it that way, but I want to do it my way, right? And so we have folks. I know folks who have left churches, over decisions about what time they're going to meet on Sunday. Nobody was saying, let's stop gathering on Sunday. They said, well, let's adjust the time. Let's meet at a different time on Sunday. And folks have left over. Or I know of folks, when the slide thing became popular and they started putting songs on slide. Do y'all do that here? Do y'all sing off the slide? Songs off slide? Yeah. I know people who left churches over there. Now, nobody was advocating we stop worshiping God or that we build an idol to Baal and worship him. They were saying, hey, we're going to do the singing thing in a little different way. And it divided God's people. So when we go into these conversations, it's vital that we know the difference between a purpose and a strategy. We're not going to compromise on our purposes, but sometimes there's some wiggle room with strategies. There's more than one right way to do things. And sometimes talking together, we wind up like Paul and Barnabas, coming up with another idea that's even better than the one they had at the beginning, that either of their choices. You see that? So let me come back to the point. When we want folks to feel safe jumping into a crucial conversation with us, they need to feel like we're in this together. We're trying to do the same thing. They can't be feeling funny about what I'm really after. If I want to shut them out or overrun their feelings or their ideas, or if I've got some agenda that's going to hurt them, they got to believe that we're together and we're trying to do the same thing. Okay, so that's about my halfway point. I want to stop and ask if anybody has a question or a comment they'd like to follow up with. You got anything in the back, Tim? Yes, sir. I don't like the way you're grinning at me. Yes. I don't know. I suppose that some of that has to do with heart, and that's going to have to be judged by each person's heart. I would say going to the example of service times or songs off slides. I think if I have made that into an issue of truth and error, then I'm making a mistake. And that's the thing that concerns me about that. The other thing is that I'm just real concerned with the propensity we have to get angry about something and pack up our marbles and go somewhere else. Biblically speaking, the idea is to work real hard at getting along with each other. I think we just give up too quickly and too often over stuff that doesn't matter. Listen, I've got a buddy of mine who had to pack up and leave a church. He stayed there for several years fighting error, and he just lost. He had to leave. I totally get that. I see that as such a different thing than saying, I didn't get my way in this vote in the business meeting, so hey, I'm just going to protest by leaving. I just don't think that's what the Spirit had in mind when he says, be diligent to preserve the unity of the Spirit and the bond of peace. And so that's why I say, I think we need to make that decision. There are times where a person has to leave because a church is in error. And there are times when they're just doing something different, and maybe I need to try to hang around and work with that. That's what I would say about that. Good question. Anybody else? Okay? I want to give you something else to write down on your sheet. Because again, we're thinking about helping people feel safe, really jumping into a crucial conversation with us. So if they think we're all trying to do the same thing, that's helpful. The other thing that is vital is mutual respect. They need to feel like that the parties in this conversation respect each other. So I want to try to explain this point with an illustration, okay? So my illustration is going to be about a pretend deacon named Kenny. And here is Kenny's story. Kenny is an imaginary deacon at a make-believe congregation. The elders of that congregation are concerned about their Bible class program. They feel like it's been a long time since it's been overhauled and looked at, and it's not as effective as it could be. And so they've asked Kenny if he would evaluate the program and make some proposals to them on how they can improve it. Now, you need to know that Kenny is an engineer. I was told to tread lightly when I said that tonight. Does that tell you enough about how Kenny approaches life? Someone else said yes, not me. So Kenny is an engineer, meticulous about everything that he does, and he brings that meticulous nature to this assignment. His research takes him 6 months because he wants to sit in different classes. He wants to evaluate every page of the curriculum. He's in the workroom tallying every last paperclip that they have. He wants to understand the program thoroughly. After several months of doing that, he sits down and he begins crafting his proposal. It is 12 pages long. It includes all kinds of charts and graphs. He's got a 32-slide PowerPoint presentation when he sits down to talk to the elders about what needs to happen in Bible class. Question: do Kenny and the elders share mutual purpose? Yes or no? Yes. What do they want to do? Make Bible class great. That's exactly right. We want to have great Bible classes. In fact, they're all about honoring God in this and helping their children. In fact, they even seem to be of the same mind that there is work to be done here. He does have a 12-page presentation. So, the time comes. He meets with the elders. He spends an hour going through this presentation and all of his slides, explaining everything that he's learned, and then making all of his proposals. When he gets finished with his presentation, the elders have some questions. One of them, Roger, is a little concerned about how he's broken up the Bible classes because he's created more classes with fewer students, and that's going to require more teachers. And Roger's thinking, do we have enough for that? And then one line of his proposal includes like $16,000 for a new copier. Ed is a Depression era elder. He's the oldest guy, worried about every nickel and dime, and he sees $16,000, and I mean, he's like freaking out mentally. Whoa, whoa, whoa. Do we even have money for something like that? So, for 30 minutes after Kenny's presentation, he's getting all kinds of questions like that. At first, he just kind of raises his eyebrows a little bit. But when it continued, then he's frowning. And after several minutes of it, he kind of leans back in his chair and he folds his arm across his chest and he huffs a little. And then as it went on longer and longer, finally, it's when Ed got to the $16,000 copier. He's kind of having a meltdown about that. Kenny starts packing up his stuff. And he's getting ready to leave. And he says to the elders, hey, if you guys don't like my plan, you could just get someone else to do this job. First question, is that a straw man? Do things like that ever happen? Yes or no? Y'all react. Yo, yes. We do things like this among us, right? It's not all that uncommon. This is an easy story to craft. Let me ask you this question. What did the elders miss? Think back to Thursday night. They missed the turn, didn't they? This didn't sneak up on them. Kenny was given clues all along that this conversation was turning. They were too involved in the content, and they weren't paying attention to the conditions. Remember the importance of watching people during crucial conversations? Listen, this guy signaled that this was turning for him, and they just never read the signals. Now, third question I was asked is, do you think there's a temptation that the elders will respond badly to this? Guy starts packing up his stuff, saying, fine, you guys can just get someone else to do this. I think if I'm an elder sitting in that room, there'd be a part of me that says, well, we sure can. Who does he think he is? He can just come in here and throw all this stuff at us, and we're just supposed to just buy it without any questions? What's wrong with him? How did we get this guy to do this job? You think an elder could respond that way? Not saying should he. Sometimes what happens to us, folks, when a conversation starts heating up, we get swept up in that emotional tide, and at the most important moments, we are at our worst. So how easy would it be just to bulldoze right over him? He's really going to silence, isn't he? He's leaving the room. And we'll just get someone else to do the job. And that would have been a failed conversation. So let me talk a little bit about what needed to happen at a moment like this, and then we'll get to talking about respect. I promise I'm heading there. I'm just taking a long time to get there. First of all, what the elders need to do with Kenny is they need to learn to recode his behavior. Instead of just thinking, wow, he's kind of temperamental, or boy, he sure gets his feelings hurt easy, what they need to be saying to themselves is, he doesn't feel safe. He's going silent. He's stepping out of this conversation. He doesn't feel safe participating in this anymore. And so we need to do something about that. What do you do? Well, you step out of the content, which just basically means quit talking about Bible classes. This guy needs to feel safe jumping back into the dialogue with the elders. Before you can ever begin to talk about classes, you need to deal with what's wrong with Kenny. That is such an important lesson to learn. Can I say married couples really need to learn that lesson? One of the biggest problems in marital conflicts is the problem of escalation. So you guys are sitting there paying bills, right? And all of a sudden you start trading barbs with each other about how each of you overspends. And then as that conflict goes on, you kind of up the ante a little bit and get a little more insulting and a little more degrading. And the next thing you know, there's a big blow-up fight over the bills. You know, if that's what's happening, the first thing you need to do is stop paying bills and talk to each other about what's going wrong in the conversation. That second step is really important. When conversations are turning crucial, first thing to do is stop talking about whatever the issue is. Something's wrong, and it needs to be fixed. What needs to be fixed is safety. So maybe what the elders do with Kenny as he's starting to pack up is they say, wait, Kenny. I know we're asking a lot of questions, but listen, we really appreciate the work that you've done. And like you, we want these Bible classes to be better. We want to do this with you. We're gonna make this work. Please, hang on a second. We need you to help us with this. You see what we're doing there? We're going back to establishing mutual purpose. And maybe that'll be enough for Kitty. Maybe once you get that ground covered and say, hey, say, listen, we're in this together, maybe he can settle back down and join the conversation. And if he can, well, then we can go back and we can begin to talk about that. You see the steps there? That process is really important. When a conversation turns crucial, see it for what it is. Stop talking about the subject. Make that person feel safe again. And only when they're safe can you go back and you talk about it. Now, I am suspicious that Kenny's not only needing some mutual purpose here. I think he's also having some problems with feeling disrespected. Can you see that? Can you see the possibility that Kenny might feel like the elders don't respect him here? Which brings us back to that second safety issue. People need to feel respected if they're going to join the conversation. It goes back to what we were saying last night about dialogue. We need to value other people's input. We need to believe that all the parties who have a stake in this have something relevant to add, so that I want to hear what other people have to say. And so they need to feel that. They need to sense that we respect them and value their input and that we want to hear from them. The authors of the book make this very interesting statement. They say respect is like air. When it is present, we hardly notice it, but when it is missing, we notice nothing else. That's true, isn't it? I bet nobody here tonight in the last 40 minutes since we've been in here started thought, wow, it sure is great to have all this oxygen. Right? Anybody think about that? And yet, if there was some mechanism for immediately extracting this oxygen out of the room, you would not be interested in learning more about mutual respect. Right? You would be saying, I need to breathe now. So if you could get that in your mind, that is exactly what happens in crucial conversations when people feel disrespected. It's game over, folks. We're not talking about Bible classes. We're not talking about fixing a marriage. We are protecting dignity. That's why Kenny is leaving the room. He has been disrespected. He believes he has been. And he's getting out of there. He's going to silence. And you know we all have been in that position, haven't we? We can understand how he's feeling. Because you've been talking to someone, right? Maybe you've been in a meeting. And you made a comment and somebody rolled their eyes. Or someone went, oh, you got to be kidding me. So, again, I think in this area, disciples have a distinct advantage. I think our worldview teaches us, equips us with respect for other people. Have you thought about that? We believe Genesis 1:26 that God created man in his image. And so whoever we're talking about out here in the world, whether it's my brother in Christ or some guy I work with or just some dude I ran into at the gas station, there is a fundamental value we attach to those people because we believe they are made in the image of God and that they are creatures with a dual nature. Matthew 10:28 teaches us that we have both a body and a soul. We believe every human being has a soul that's going to live on forever. In fact, we believe it's our responsibility to try to help that person know Christ, that that's the most important issue in their life. In fact, the Bible teaches us even with people we count as our enemies, what are we supposed to do for them? Love them. Which doesn't mean I always feel warm, fuzzy, good feelings about them. It just means I always want to do what's their best for them, always act in their best interest. And then there's all the passages that talk about being kind and gentle with people like Ephesians 4:32. All of those things, folks, all those things are part of who we are. They're part of our character as Christians, and they attach to us an innate respect for other human beings. In fact, it's interesting. I told you, this book I've been referencing is not written from a biblical perspective. It's not a religious book. And so when they talk about mutual respect, that's a real problem for them. How do you respect people? What makes you respect people who aren't very respectable? They don't have the advantage that we do. We respect all human beings. It's part of our spiritual DNA. It's who we are. Now, don't misunderstand that. When I say we respect all people, it does not mean that we agree with everything that they do, or that we even value their character and their behavior. That's not what I mean. It does mean that I believe they're created in the image of God, and that they possess an eternal soul, and that they're lost and need the gospel, and that I'm supposed to love them and be kind to them and gentle with them. And all of those things move me to act in their best interest. I don't have to search for some reason to respect them. I already do. So since that's true, the question is, how do I communicate that to them in the midst of a crucial conversation? How do I get that message across? This is a little bit more difficult than mutual purpose, because the issue of respect is a little more complicated. Sometimes things happen that we perceive of as being disrespectful that aren't at all. And then sometimes behavior is legitimately disrespectful. So I want to come back to Kenny's story, and I want you to tell me, do you feel like the elders did not respect him? Yes or no? Did they respect him? I think these guys absolutely respected Kenny. They chose him to do this job. They were interested in the information that he had to share. So I think that this problem is a perceived lack of respect, not a legitimate act of respect. So what do we do when people just feel like we've disrespected them, and that's not really what's going on? When disrespect is only perceived, one of the methods recommended in the book is that you correct it with contrasting. And what they mean by that is this: you tell them what you do don't mean, and you tell them what you do mean. Have you guys heard that before? Tell them what you don't mean, and tell them what you do mean. For example, in Kenny's case, I think the elders would need to say, hey, please don't misunderstand our questions. We are not asking you these questions because we disagree with you or we don't appreciate or approve of your work. What we do need to be sure is that we understand every piece of this, because it's going to be our job to sell this to the teachers and to the parents and to the church family when we implement this program. So we will have to ask you some tough questions as we process all of this and try to understand. Here's what I don't mean. Here's what I do mean. You see what I'm saying? You notice there's no apology there, because there was no disrespect intended. Over and over again, for this unduly overpriced copier, finally Ed says, oh, brother, are we doing this again? Would that be disrespectful? Yeah. So when it's legit, when you've said or done something that disrespected somebody, how do you fix that? Yeah, you know the answer. You apologize. Only one way to fix that, to apologize. I have to confess that I've been guilty of that. Frankly, guys, I've been in some marriage counseling sessions that were extraordinarily frustrating. And here we go, down the same path again, arguing about the same issue, and I've just kind of leaned back and rolled my eyes. All you care about. I've had people, you know what? I'm sorry. That was an inappropriate reaction on my part. Please forgive me. It's what you have to do. Happens to all of us, and it's the only way to correct disrespect when it's been present in a conversation. If you don't fix it and restore respect, you're not getting anywhere in the conversation. So, what have we identified tonight? Identify two areas where we need to work to help people feel safe. If we want them wading into this crucial conversation with us so that it's all going to work out good, first of all, they need to know we are all pulling in the same direction. We are in this together. And secondly, we need to know that we value them and what they have to say to us. I got to tell you something, folks, of all the methodologies I've learned in the book, these two things have been the most helpful to me in a very practical way in talking. Want to make conversations turn out well? Keep reminding them, we are in this together. And I value and appreciate what you have to say. So that's what I wanted to say tonight. Let me pause now. Did you get any questions? Poor Tim is standing in the back doing nothing. You guys need to help him out with that. Let me open it up and ask you, would you like to add a comment to what's been said tonight, or would anyone like to follow up with a question? So you're saying I'm the good guy and I know about crucial conversations and I'm actually on the receiving end of the disrespect now. I think you've got two choices to make in that situation. One, a choice is just to kind of be a big boy and say, okay, he's had a bad moment. I'm still going to keep working at this. That's one option. The other option is to say, let's stop for a minute. What you just did when you rolled your eyes, it makes me feel like you don't value my input. Acknowledge it. Yeah. I think it's, and again, now what you've done is you've taken a crucial conversation and you've kind of hatched another little one right next to it. We need to talk about the disrespect. And really, that's kind of up to you. And candidly, I do that both ways sometimes, to be honest with you. Sometimes people do things and I don't really think they mean it. I think it was just kind of a bad moment for them. And so I'm willing to say, yeah, I'm going to let that slide and we're going to keep working this and working this. And then other times, I think they need to be called out for it because maybe it's an ongoing problem that's destroyed. What other questions do you have tonight or a comment you would like to add? So are you asking me how often people come into a meeting? I think, okay, so remember one of the definitions of a crucial conversation is opinions vary. And I think in almost every crucial conversation, at the beginning, people believe they're cross purpose. They have cross purposes, that they're not together. Which is one of the reasons I think mutual purpose is so valuable, to get that in early and at the beginning. Because I think sometimes, brothers and sisters, we forget how much we share in common and how much we are really trying to do together. And most of the time, our differences are over very, very small things. And so I think it's helpful to be reminded about that. The difficulty with that is people have a hard time seeing that when they're mad. And so that's why you really need someone who will bring a calming influence. Okay. A bad agenda. So they come into the meeting with an agenda and they're not going to be dissuaded from it. I don't know if I can give you a percentage answer to that. I think, again, it's not going to be different from what I've already said. Again, we're dealing with other disciples, which in working this gives us all kinds of advantages. I believe that the vast majority of disciples are good guys. We don't always behave like we are. But I think in our core we are. So when we go back and we get to the bedrock principles, I think in the vast majority of cases, people can be brought around. I don't know if that exactly answers your question, but you can come to me afterwards. We can talk some more about it if you'd like to do that. But that's an important thought. I'm going to say it again. We are together a lot more than we think we are, especially when we're mad and dug in on something. Yeah. So, yes. So remember that this was not a book written to churches. And these guys have gone out and touted these tactics and radically altered corporate settings with the principles that you and I are talking about. I mention that to you only because if just writing a human book with no scripture at all and no adherence to a biblical worldview, just using the strategies can change people, how much easier it should it be for us when we've got the benefit of God and His Word that bind us together in a unique relationship and a unique view of everything. I think we have all the advantages of working on this. Candidly, among God's people, this ought to be easier for us. Who else has a question? Yes, Tim? Is this your question or someone else's?
Yeah. How do you approach that, address that?
So you're talking about disrespect directed toward you? Okay, so let me say three things about that. The first thing I'm going to say is Sunday night, I'm going to talk about hard cases and the fact that this book is not some kind of a panacea that guarantees a positive outcome every time, okay? And that's what nobody is claiming that. There are some legitimately hard cases where you may not be able to accomplish what you want to accomplish. If there was, let me give a hypothetical. You have a family setting where you have siblings trying to decide about the care of elderly parents, and there's been some acrimony and some ongoing disrespect from one family member toward another. I think there needs to be a crucial conversation about that. That if we're going to work together, we need to respect each other. I think that's the conversation that I would want to have. And then the third thing that I would say is, brothers and sisters, we always blaze the trail by setting the example. We don't ever allow a wicked person to pull us down to their level. And so one of the things that we would talk about a lot if we were doing this class over 3 months is not getting swept up in the emotional tide. And so I think our propensity is to be pulled down to the lowest common denominator. So if I've got a sibling who's always being ugly and disrespectful toward me, I give it right back to them. I think what we need to do is have the opposite instinct, to set a good example, to behave in the right way. And unless they're just a completely wicked person, over time, I think that can help begin to modify their behavior. So that would be my suggestion about that. It's a tough situation. And Sunday night, I'll deal more in detail about managing tough situations. Good questions. Anybody else? Yeah. So you're jumping ahead to tomorrow morning, which is going to be a really important study about the stories we tell ourselves, about the words and actions of other people. And candidly, that's critical. Learning to manage how we interpret other people's behavior is a key part of this. Because listen, once we tell ourselves a story about what someone said and did, it's going to trigger our feelings and it's going to start directing our actions. So managing that story is really, really important. Now y'all can stay home. You don't have to come tomorrow morning, because that was class in a nutshell. Anybody else? All right. I appreciate you being here tonight. This more than I can say. The crowds have been outstanding every single night. I don't know if y'all know how rare that is, but it is rare indeed. And I really, really appreciate that. And I just want to let you know that that has been an awful lot to me. I'm looking forward to Lord's Day. My wife told me driving up today, she said, you know, after tonight, you'll be half done. And she said, I don't know how that makes you feel about tomorrow, because all of the other half is tomorrow. So get a good night's rest, and we'll dig in and have three more sessions.